The English Civil Wars, 1639 to 1660. The Battle of Newbury, Part 3. Now, the battle began on September the 20th. The Parliamentarian army under Essex was awakened before dawn, and initial reports stated that Essex actually went from regiment to regiment, asking them if they were ready for battle. After consultation, the army advanced with most cheerful and courageous spirits at around 7 a.m. They were divided into three bodies of foot, both lined and flanked by bodies of horse, with a reserve behind them. The army was preceded by Stapleton's cavalry, which quickly cleared the royalist pickets and allowed Essex's advance to what is known as Wash Common, a patch of open ground between the two forces. This march took approximately an hour due to the heavy clay soil being soaked from the previous night's rain. The open space before Biggs Hill, the objective of their march, allowed for a much welcome chance to regroup. Royalist Commander Rupert had established a cavalry guard on Biggs Hill. While the size is unknown, it was large enough to attack the Parliamentarian horse head-on. Stapleton waited until the Royalists were close before firing, leading to the faltering of their charge in the advance of the Parliamentarian cavalry that then drove them off with their swords. The cavalry were unable to make further gains, having engaged only a small part of the Royalist cavalry and being unwilling to press their attack against the larger body. Led by Philip Skipton, the parliamentary right flank attacked their main objective, which was nearby Roundhill. Their account reported that they charged so fiercely that they beat the Royalists from the hill, but makes no mention of casualties or what happened to the Royalist guns, which were allegedly deployed there. The Royalists claimed the hill was undefended. The facts suggest that this was closer to the truth, and the king and his generals had simply been caught napping. Its capture allowed Skipton to position 1,000 musketeers on top, who could now fire down on any Royalist party advancing. As a result of this quick advance, Charles found his army in chaos. With Skipton's forces organized and flanking them, the Royalist Council of War reconvened to discuss the events, and accounts suggest the meeting was acrimonious. The fall of Round Hill described as a most gross and absurd error. Rupert tried to contain both Essex and Skipton. Leaving two regiments of horse with Byron, he led the remainder of the cavalry to Essex's position on the left flank. Byron, in the meantime, was commanded to support any attack by Royalist musketeers on Skipton's forces, drawing his regiments up behind the infantry, ready to second them in case the enemy cavalry should advance towards them. Now, Rupert's advance has been criticized by both Parliamentarian and Royalist sources. Instead of a small engagement, the stubbornness of the Parliamentarian resistance forced Rupert to commit more and more forces into the battle, eventually turning a series of small engagements into a full-scale battle, with reinforcements gradually being drawn in. The terrain limited the localized advantage of Rupert's forces that they had in numbers, but after three attacks, Stapleton's brigade crumbled. This allowed Rupert to hook around Essex's left flank, stop his advance, and capture five pieces of artillery. However, this came at a cost. The Royalists took heavy casualties and failed to completely break Essex's infantry. The infantry instead stubbornly retreated, allowing the Parliamentarian cavalry to reorganize behind them. Even though his advance had been stopped, Essex was not yet beaten. Byron's attack on Skipton's musketeers in the center also went poorly. Pushing three regiments of foot forward, the force suffered similarly high casualties in an attempt to take Round Hill. After the attack stalled, the cavalry had to be called in to force it forward. Despite heavy losses due to the only avenue of advance being a narrow lane lined with Parliamentarian musketeers, this move succeeded in allowing Byron to take Round Hill, forcing the Parliamentarian infantry back to a hedge on the far side. The attack eventually lost momentum, and although Round Hill was taken, Byron was unable to advance any further. On the right flank, William Vavasour attempted to overwhelm the Parliamentarian flank with a substantial brigade of infantry, which included a small amount of cavalry support. His initial attack was repulsed thanks to artillery from the Parliamentarian side, but a subsequent head-on attack forced Skipton's beleaguered forces in the center to send several regiments over to assist, with the fight turning into a bloody melee. Vavasour's force was eventually forced to retire, with parliamentarians failing to give ground. After heavy fighting, the royalists had succeeded in pushing Essex's forces back briefly. They had given ground, but not retreated from the battle, and the main force of infantry still remained strong. In an attempt to proceed, Essex waved his infantry and light artillery forward. Rupert's cavalry was too weak to defend against this advance due to its large firepower, and he instead ordered two regiments of foot commanded by John Bellasi to halt Essex. The parliamentarian records report they were hotly charged by the enemy's horse and foot, who succeeded in forcing Essex slowly back, although the fight took 4 hours. In response, Essex called for Skippon to send him reinforcements. Skippon obliged by ordering a Mainwaring's regiment of infantry to remove themselves from his line and march to replace some of Essex's exhausted soldiers. As soon as they arrived, they were charged by two bodies of cavalry and a regiment of infantry under John Byron, who forced the regiment to retreat. The royalists hacked down the fleeing parliamentarians, and according to Byron, his force had not left a man of them unkilled, but that the hedges were so high the horses could not pursue them. Although the royalists failed to press this attack due to the difficulty of maneuvering cavalry in the field, and Essex briefly retook the ground, the loss of this infantry regiment opened the gap in the parliamentarian line. If Rupert was able to drive through this gap, he would break Essex's army into two wings and would be able to encircle them. Recognizing this possibility, he began redeploying the royalist force. Two regiments of cavalry and a regiment of infantry under his command would occupy Essex, while two regiments under Charles Gerard would push through the gap in the parliamentarian line. Luckily for the parliamentarians, Skippon saw this opening and ordered the red and blue regiments of the London-trained bands to close the gap. Although they succeeded in bridging the gap between the two wings, there was no cover, and a royalist battery of 8 heavy guns drawn up on the high ground began firing on them. Unable to move because of the necessity of their position, they were left enduring close-range artillery fire. Resisting two attacks by royalist cavalry and infantry led by Jacob Astley, historian John Day notes that the records show the most trained band casualties were hit in the head, while a survivor boasted that the artillery did us no harm, only the shot broke our pikes. Evidently, in the heat of the battle, the royalist artillery was firing too high. Despite this, the royalist artillery fire had taken its toll, and the trained band regiments were forced to retreat. The royalists pursued, and only close-quarter musket fire allowed the militia to regroup without substantial losses. After regrouping, the militia was again attacked by two regiments of foot and two of cavalry, who, despite surrounding the Londoners and dragging away a cannon, were unable to break them. At this point, both armies began to draw apart. Although sporadic fighting continued as night fell, by midnight both forces had disengaged completely. Both army councils met. Essex's plan to force his way past the royalists seemed feasible, and many parliamentarians, loath to give up the ground they had taken, fully expected the battle to continue. The royalists, on the other hand, were plagued by poor morale, heavy losses, and lack of supplies, having used 80 of their 90 barrels of gunpowder. Although Rupert argued for the battle to continue, he was outvoted. The next morning, Essex was allowed to bypass the royalist force without issue and continue his retreat towards London. The parliamentary force, now free of Charles's army, retreated towards Aldermaston as quickly as possible and eventually made it to Reading and then London, where Essex received a hero's welcome. The royalists, on the other hand, were forced to spend the next day recovering their casualties, finding more than 1,000 injured soldiers who were sent back to Oxford. After they finished recovering their dead and wounded, the royalists left 200 infantry, 25 cavalry, and 4 guns in Dunnington Castle to defend their rear and then march to Oxford, having buried their dead officers in Newbury Guildhall. Casualties at Newbury eventually came to approximately 1,300 losses for the royalists and 1,200 for the parliamentarians. The loss at Newbury was due to a multitude of factors. Day gives credit to the greater ability of Essex to conserve his forces through the campaign, which put the Royalists at a numerical disadvantage by the time they got to Newbury. He also notes that the Royalists' over-reliance on cavalry, with Essex compensating for much lamented lack of cavalry by tactical ingenuity and firepower, countering Rupert's cavalry by driving them off with mass infantry formations. The Royalist infantry were also outperformed, Essex's force retaining a high level of cohesiveness, while the Royalists were described as relatively unprofessional. Both historians Day and Warden also give the paucity of ammunition and gunpowder as an endemic deciding factor in the success or the failure of Charles's campaign. Although the attention of the historians is normally on the larger battles, such as Edge Hill and Marston Moor, several historians who have studied the period consider the First Battle of Newbury to be the defining moment of the First English Civil War, both as the high point of the Royalist advance and as the one bright period of Essex's generalship. Historian Day writes that militarily and politically, Parliament's position at the beginning of October of 1643 was demonstrably far stronger than in late July. With hindsight, the capture of Bristol was the high tide of Charles's war, his best and only chance of ending the conflict on his terms. Historian Barrett noted that the Royalists had failed in what might prove to have been their best chance to destroy the main Parliamentarian army in the field, and hoped a crushing victory would bring down the Parliamentarian war party into ruins. The high parliamentary feelings after Newbury led to the signing of the Solemn League and Covenant, which of course brings the powerful Scottish army into the scene and down on the Royalists. Thanks to the failure to win a decisive victory there, the English, the Welsh, the Scottish, and Irish subjects, all of King Charles' three kingdoms, would henceforth pay a bloody price in a steadily widening and deepening war. The Battle of Newbury has been described as both the longest battle of the English Civil War and the one that historians have found the greatest difficulty in describing. And this is because there is no contemporary plan of the battlefield or record of the plans of each side, while conversely, there are diverse and contradictory accounts from both sides of the battle. An official Royalist account was written by Lord Digby on September the 22nd, which suffered from defects due to Digby's position away from the main fighting, and because it was designed as a reflection on the battle's outcome, not a blow-by-blow description of what happened. Conversely, those written by officers who actually fought in the main battle area are very narrow in focus. On the parliamentary side, an official source was published a month after the battle. Due to the circumstances of its publication and the high parliamentarian morale after Newbury, it made no attempt to gloss over errors and was designed to explain to a lay readership what had happened on the battlefield. Cavaliers vs. Roundheads, The English Civil War, 1642-1649 by Hibbert. English Civil War, 1640-1660 by Warden. English Civil War Atlas and Concise History of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, 1639-51 by Lipscomb. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out the merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.